This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. For more information, go to FUBARradio.com.
You're listening to Femi on FUBAR Radio.
What I, members of the Cabinet and the whole government are doing is working to ensure that we leave the European Union with a deal.
Many people are still advocating for their preferred, most pure version of the outcome. What we need is that time pressure to start to make people think about practical solutions, about finding a common ground and a compromise that allows us to go forward as a nation.
The Right Honourable Gentleman has been willing to sit down with Hamas, Hezbollah and the IRA without preconditions, yet he won't meet me to talk about Brexit. In this case, he's neither present nor involved.
Mr. Speaker, actually, I did reach out to the Prime Minister last September when I offered to discuss our deals with her. And it appears that, Mr. Speaker, that while the door to her office may well be opened, apparently the minds inside it are completely closed.
The Prime Minister could indicate that seeking an extension of 3 months, that would indicate that she was serious about sitting down with people and talking, in particular the trade unions. You know, this meeting I've had today is 2.5 years too late.
Please don't listen to the Brexiteers' madness, which asserts that because we have huge plans here, we will not move and we will always be here. They are wrong.
Welcome back. This is Femi. This is the floor is yours. Here I'm joined by Emma Burnell, chair of Open Labour and a political commentator. Oh, it's been a week. So this week we're going to be discussing the housing crisis. But what's happened this week? So we've had after the Brexit deal got voted down last week. They were supposed to come back with a new Brexit plan, their Plan B. And that was supposed to say what the government was going to do, what the plan was for Brexit, given that they literally had none. And then that got presented, as you just heard. Basically, Labour wants the government to take no deal off the table so that we can't leave with no deal. Theresa May is refusing to do that. And so they've been going back and forth like children, basically saying, you take no deal off the table. You know, I want no deal. No, blah, blah, blah. It's been basically that for the entire week. And it's just in a complete mess. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I think complete mess just about sums it up. I don't think there is no mess. I mean, everything's a mess.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, while we have this huge mess, everything else is a mess because we're only concentrated on this mess.
Precisely. And I've said it before. I mean, the one thing, I think there are two things that unite the country around Brexit right now. And that is, one, nobody likes the deal. The 52% that voted for more control hate a deal that means we have less control. The 48% that wanted to stay in the EU hate a deal that takes us out of the EU. So we've now spent 2.5 years negotiating something that literally nobody voted for.
And it's very Theresa May to find the one option that everybody hates.
Exactly. It is a skill. I've often referred to it as professional incompetence.
I think that's possibly giving her slightly too much credit.
we're on that. And but as you mentioned, we're not dealing with the actual issues that matter to people. I mean, we've had... the Brexit vote was largely about people saying this isn't good enough, and that related to things like the NHS, the regional inequality, the lack of democratic representation because of our constituency-based voting system, and of course the housing crisis. Now, this is one of those topics that I don't really, it's not my area of expertise. I studied law, didn't really come up with a lot of housing other than land law, which I didn't do particularly well in. I want to hear from you. So if you want to tweet us, tweet at FUBAR Radio, or you can call 0330-223-0200 to get involved. The floor is yours. What needs to happen regarding the housing crisis, do you reckon?
Well, I know that you've got Tom Copley coming on later, so I'm going to usurp him by using his catchphrase. And the answer is, build more bloody houses.
That seems like a logical solution.
We just got to get sensible about both building more housing, but also building the right kind of housing. Building housing that people can actually afford to live in, rather than simply building endless luxury flats. I mean, where I live in East London, and there are flats going up all around that are empty most of the time because they're just being bought as investments, they're being bought as overseas properties. And, where I live, I walk past so many homeless people.
Yeah.
every Christmas, so this year is like I did like I do every year, as soon as I get too fed up with my family, I go down and I volunteer at Crisis at Christmas. Mm. And it's just every year it gets more heartbreaking and more difficult, and you just feel like, well, this week, great, we've given people somewhere to stay, we're giving them advice, we're giving them help. Where are we the other 51 weeks of the year? We can't keep doing it as volunteers. Yeah. It's, the state has got to step up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's absolutely horrendous that we are literally stepping over the homelessness problem because we're dealing with this utter distraction. And it's just not getting better. In fact, I have noticed it's been gotten noticeably worse. And when you look at, I mean, I think it was Shelter pointed out that it was 600,000. What is it? How many houses across England that are vacant right now? I think it was 600,000 or so. And
there are 4,500 people sleeping rough.
Yeah.
I don't know about the vacant housing, but there are 1.3 million houses needed. And we are not building them. Mm. And we are, even when we do build housing, we're building the wrong kind of housing because there's no financial incentive to build the right kind of housing. In fact, councils are financially crippled by the fact that as soon as they build anything half decent, they have to sell it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of the problem. And yeah, it's 600,000 empty homes, and it's because the government isn't basically pulling its weight and leaving it to private companies to build these houses that they think, well, we can't make that much money off of poor people, but we can make a lot of money if we build massive luxury mansions. So let's go with that instead, because the people that really need homes are the top 1%.
Yeah, and as I said, the market has demonstrably failed.
Mm.
Yeah, and what states are for is to step in when the market fails. And we have seen failure. This isn't a new failure. This has been failing for years and years and years. It's got a lot worse under austerity, because what the Labour government did when it was doing a bit more state intervention at a later stage, they were not building housing, something I'm very cross with them about. But at a later stage, they did intervene a lot more. There was just less rough sleeping. They almost completely eliminated it. That has just completely gone under austerity. The last 8 years has just got worse and worse. And meanwhile, council budgets are being cut to the bone. So they're only providing the services that they absolutely legally have to provide.
Mm.
And that means that an awful lot of the services that they used to provide that were non-statutory just aren't there anymore.
Absolutely ridiculous. I mean, you've got a podcast, so I imagine you've discussed this as well. But you also talk about American politics and Roger Stone. What were you talking about regarding Roger Stone?
Not on my podcast. Actually, discusses politics and popular culture.
Mm.
So we did a wonderful episode with the journalist John Elledge about Our Friends in the North, which is all about sort of, in many ways, the long sweep of housing crisis history.
Mm.
So if anyone is interested in how we got here, I highly recommend watching Our Friends in the North, because it will give you a really good grounding on where we got to by the 90s.
Mm.
So this isn't new. Mm. But actually, I mean, in terms of the Roger Stone thing, my other podcast that I was doing, we do a weekly kind of discussion on politics.
Mm.
As you'll have seen today, Roger Stone, huge Trump ally, has been arrested, raided by the FBI very early in the morning. Several accusations of lying to Congress, which is similar to perjury.
Yeah.
And in the documents, there's an awful lot of references to person one.
Mm.
And in terms of, you know, you use an euphemism like person one to not identify someone, although this person one happens to be currently residing in the Ecuadorian embassy, so I think we can probably all guess roughly who person one is.
Yeah. Okay, well, you chair Open Labour.
Yes.
Can you tell us something about that?
Open Labour is a new grouping within Labour, because, you know, obviously Labour Party didn't have enough factions, so we decided we needed a new one. We're basically what the sort of internationalist left of the Labour Party. We have similar politics to lots of other people, but we're trying to do it in a slightly different way, a very open way, a less controlled way, a lot less sort of internal sort of... I wouldn't say oppression, but you will stick to the line. Trust me, as chair, I can honestly tell you, no one has ever stuck to the line at Open Labour.
Okay, so it's a lot more horizontal, flat-based, everyone has a voice sort of thing.
Absolutely. Now, that doesn't mean to say that we don't take some stances. We took a very strong stance on the anti-Semitism crisis in the summer, you know, saying that this was appalling. We came out saying that no one should vote for Pete Wilsman, for example. We've taken a pretty strong line. We have a great pamphlet on laying out what the different options for Europe look like. I wouldn't say that we're completely, as an organisation, where I am in terms of wanting a people's vote, but we're getting there. We've got a conference on Saturday which will vote on some of these options, saying where we think the Labour Party should go. But we're very much sort of either people's vote or Norway, I would say. We're very much on that side of the party debate.
Cool. And so... I mean, you say you're on the left of Labour, as you mentioned. There are other elements within the left of Labour. Are all the left of Labour pro Corbyn, or are there different parts of the left of Labour that are pro Corbyn? And how does that work together?
Well, I think one of the things that we really try to do at Open Labour is not make it about personalities.
Agreed.
Make it about the politics.
Thank God for that.
Well, quite. Yeah. I mean, I've been a Labour Party member for 28 years. I'm very old. And I've criticised every Labour leader, and I've praised every Labour leader. And long may it continue, because no one's perfect and no one's terrible.
Absolutely. I can't tell you how much I appreciate hearing that. The idea, the personality politics that we've been seeing for the past few years has just been such a disappointment. The idea that you can't have a policy because it's supported by this person, or that you have to have a policy because it's supported by this person. Whereas people, I mean, it's that gang mentality that is ruining politics. It's the same thing you have in America, whereby if you're a Republican, you have to sign up to every single one of the things Republicans believe in. You must believe in, you must be against abortion, you must be pro-gun control, you must be, and it's what led to them voting for Trump, because, well, I guess he's our guy now. I guess we believe in all the things he believes in. And that has got to change. I mean, we've got, we'll be speaking to George Aylett in a couple of minutes, and we have a really good rapport. Even though we disagree strongly on what we need to do with Brexit, we understand each other, we respect each other, we understand that we have the same views about how Britain needs to change. But our followers often don't get that. today, when George announced...
You mean people don't understand subtlety on Twitter?
he'll be here in a second to discuss what the reaction to posting that he'll be discussing with me let's just say there were some fairly strong emotions to the idea that we'd be talking together. So we've got a tweet here that says 100%, and this is from Pontian Commander, who says 100%, it's a hot mess right now. The worst thing is that some people are settling for this. Politicians lack accountability. They lie and serve themselves and not the people they represent. It's an absolute travesty right now that the ordinary people are blindly suffering due to austerity. And that is kind of the point. We have a large part of what led us to this particular moment is that the politicians have failed for a very long time.
Can I just say something slightly controversial?
Go.
Politicians have absolutely 100% failed us. I don't think many of them lie. Not outright lie. I mean, the bus was totally a lie.
Yeah.
Boris Johnson, Theresa May is actually really quite bizarre among politicians being able to lie very brazenly. But most of them will give you their best varnished version of a version of the truth. And I know that's a distinction without a difference. But I do think there is so much anti-politics mood at the moment. And I think that's part of the danger that we're in. The elites are all the same. And the idea that someone like Nigel Farage isn't the elite and I am slightly sends me loopy. But... I think it's really important that we actually take politics a bit more seriously and take politicians a bit more seriously and absolutely hold their feet to the fire, hold them to account, make sure they're doing the right job, which they are failing to do at the moment. But I think if we just fall into that all politicians are X narrative, I think that's as damaging as some of the other narratives that we get from the right.
No, I do hear you, because the moment you do have those people that are saying, well, Brexit was just the first step, we need to get rid of all politicians in general and have just a country of militias or something. you raise an absolutely good point. I mean, a lot of the when we talk about politicians lying, sometimes it is outright lies. Sometimes it's more just focusing on certain facts to the point that it skews the narrative in order to make people think certain things. For example, if you say Nigel Farage when he said the sole source of EU law is the European Commission, and they're unelected. Unelected by the people, but we elect people who then choose them, much like we elect, for example, Matt Hancock right now has the power over life or death of our entire country, but he wasn't on the ballot paper for 99.9% of the population. So effectively...
And he wasn't elected health secretary.
He wasn't elected health secretary. Theresa May chose him, along with her other list of greatly wise choices for health secretary or foreign minister. But the point is, He makes that point, even though every piece of EU law has to get approved, amended, or rejected by the European Parliament, which is directly elected. But if you only tell one fact, even though that fact in and of itself might be true, if you leave out the other elements, then you're basically convincing people that you're deceiving people.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you, and I'm not saying that either our political discourse or the politicians involved in it are doing a great job at it.
But if we tar everyone with the same brush, exactly. if we say that they're all liars, then people will lose faith in the very concept of politics.
And democracy.
And democracy, and we won't get anywhere. We will bring in George Aylett right now. Here he is. Hey, George.
Hello there. Oh, hello, Femi. How are you?
Oh, not too bad. I haven't seen you since, I think, Labour conference. Is that right?
Indeed. Oh, that was a lovely time. But yeah, no, good to talk. Always better to do it in, talking rather than just on Twitter all the time.
Exactly.
Go on, then.
It is great to hear from you. So tell me your position within Labour, exactly.
I was a former parliamentary candidate, and I'm currently a youth officer for Whole North constituency Labour Party. Mm.
And so, right today, we're going to be talking about housing. Now, as we let's first discuss what happened on Twitter about a few minutes ago, because I think, like I said, we need to fix politics like desperately as soon as this is over, because it can't continue like this. You can't have people who genuinely want to have a conversation and then have other people saying, no, we don't like that person, so you people can't discuss because we believe in you, we don't believe in what they said, therefore we don't want a conversation between the two of you. How harmful is that?
I think it's a bit... It's not really that good. I think there are certain limits you can do to it. So, for example, you can argue about giving platforms to the far right, etc. I mean, it's completely fine to debate with you, Femi. I look forward to it. And yeah, I think we do need to deal with that in politics, because rational debate is needed. And you can argue about not being able to debate irrational points like fascism, etc. But, it's very good. And, let's have this debate. Let's annoy this man. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Exactly. Well, in the spirit of annoying that guy, let's point out the things that we do actually agree. Because obviously we disagree on what to do with Brexit moving forward. But what we do agree is that the country needs radical change and it needs it as fast as possible. So we're talking about the housing crisis now. For me, personally, I think that one of the major things that we have to do with the housing crisis is regional inequality. Because if London remains being the sole land of opportunity in the country, then places like Hull, where there should be more houses built, won't have the industry that they need to create the jobs. And therefore, the people there won't be able to afford housing. And if you directed industry to that place, it would make housing grow around the area.
Well, I think you're right about the point about power and economics. So if more power is taken out of London and given to more regions, whether that be through federalisation, etc., then I think that's quite good. I would say Hull is one of the few places in the country which is actually bucking the trend on the housing crisis. So Hull City Council, I believe they've released statistics that 96% of Hull's land has been built on. And actually, housing is the third It's the third most affordable place in the country, where the average house price can vary between, you know, 80,000 for a four-bedroom house in just outside the city centre. So Hull is one of these places which, you know, doesn't see this boom and bust from the housing crisis. I believe house prices have gone up over 160-170% across the country over the last decade or so. Hull has remained quite flat. It's gone up with inflation regardless, which is really, really good.
Well done, Hull.
And that's what happens when you actually build housing. So 96% of Hull's land has been built on, and a lot of that is housing. So that is one way to go forward. So actually, shock horror, if you build housing, then house prices will get lower. So building houses across the country. But also the point you make about power is so important. If all the jobs and opportunities in London, everyone wants to go to London, and that raises house prices.
Exactly.
So I think decentralisation will be key to moving that power and hopefully reducing house prices, not only in London, but having it all across the country as well.
Hi, George. This is Emma Burnell.
Hello there.
I just wanted to completely agree with that point. I mean, I think one of the things that has happened over the last 8 years is there has been a lot of talk about decentralisation, the Northern Powerhouse, the Midlands Engine, and so little energy and actual devolution of power has actually come in behind that. So, you know, and a whole great, you know, it's great that we have new metro mayors. I would quite like one of them not to be an old white guy, but, you know, you can't have everything. But actually, we need so much more ability for them to raise funds locally, for more money to be directed locally, and then for them to have the power to actually do something with that.
Yep.
Because it's all very well to say, build X number of council housing, but you've also got to put all sorts of infrastructure in there. You've got to have ways of attracting not just business, but the right kind of business for the right kind of jobs. So when we talk about attracting business, it's quite an old-fashioned conversation that happens about building a big Amazon warehouse, like everyone wants to go and work at Amazon. Strongly recommend James Bloodworth's book if you're ever thinking about going to work at Amazon. We need a much, much better ability for us to plan locally, to retain communities, to build communities together, and to make sure that those communities have the strength to go forward and to do what they want to do differently, so that what you do in Hull is completely different from what someone might do not that far away in Sheffield, or someone else might want to do at the other end of the country down in Penzance. It's really important that each of those places are able to plan and build properly, and they can't do that with our massively over-centralised country.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, definitely. I've got a question for you both, actually. Do you both support the idea, when it comes to decentralisation, of a federal United Kingdom where we have regional assemblies to deal with that way of decentralising power, to having a Yorkshire Assembly, a Cornish Assembly, etc.? I mean, what are your both thoughts, Emma and Sammy?
You want to go first?
For me, I think it's an interesting idea, but I worry that regional assemblies will just replicate the London problem on a slightly smaller scale.
In what sense?
So you'll get Manchester dominating the Northwest, for example, or Leeds dominating Yorkshire, rather than Leeds and Sheffield and Doncaster all having their own sources of power and centres of power. So I'm going to use a really posh, slightly wanky word now, which is subsidiarity, which is basically meaning everything goes to the right level.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons that you and I, Femi, are both pro-Europe is we think that some of those decisions should be made on a supranational level. But I'm also very much a localist, and some of those decisions should be made by local councils or groups of local councils to come together. So while I think federalism might be a step in the right direction, I worry that it's the wrong step, or slightly too small a step, George.
Okay, fair enough. What about you, Femi? What do you think?
I more or less echo that, but with less apprehension, I think, than Emma. Just purely because I think that the closer we get, the better. So the more local we get, the better. And now, as you mentioned, it could be too small a step, that maybe you just need to give more power to individual constituencies. I don't know, but I do know that definitely regional devolution is absolutely the way forward, because if we don't have that, or at least some version of that, then we're basically trusting Westminster to care about places that it's never cared about since in the whole history of the country. So I think that's definitely the step in the right direction, but I'm not an expert on this particular issue, so I would bow to both of your experiences.
I spent three years at a local government think tank, so I can outgeek both of you, I'm sure.
We've got a text in from David DFLA56 who says we need more jobs and better paid jobs for our citizens. We need more homes available right now. Now till we can build more. Only Brexit can deliver that. In fact, it already is. Reports that points to rent prices have already fallen in London and in three months in a row. What do you guys think? Is Brexit the way to solve the housing crisis?
Making the country poorer is not the way to solve the housing crisis. If you think the government aren't giving enough money now, wait until they've got less to give.
George?
It's all about the political will in the country. So the act of leaving an institution, a supranational institution, is not going to single-handedly reduce house prices. It's all about the political will and what central government does with its powers, within its own borders, to actually deal with this issue. So to deal with the housing crisis is not just leaving a political institution, it's about actually building houses all across the country. And you need to do that whether within the European Union or outside the European Union. So, yeah, we just need to build and build and build. So that's central government's responsibility.
Okay, so I think the difference between the two of you on that particular point was that Emma says Brexit is not the answer and that Brexit will actually impede our ability. George, I believe you're saying that Brexit isn't the answer, but either way, we'd still be able to fix the problem either way. Is that right?
Well, we can build housing regardless whether or not we're in a supranational entity or not. We just need to do it. We need the political will to do it. We have the political will to end poverty in this country. It doesn't matter whether or not we're in the European Union. If we have the political will to do it, there are certainly the funds to do it. We just need a government that will actually do it, and that's why we need the Labour government more than anything. So that's why I'm campaigning so much for our party, because living standards will increase whether we're inside the European Union or outside the European Union, because it's all about allocation of resources that we have. So yeah, no, we just need that government first.
What would you say to the notion that a lot of the argument, left and right, a lot of the left versus right argument is basically people on the right saying, yes, but your policy wouldn't work because your policy of government intervention is simply going to lead to more debt. And so the argument against that is, no, it's a sound policy. There will be enough money. We will not run into debt. So in theory, if we take that basis, You have to say, all right, if something happens that makes the country fundamentally poorer, doesn't that increase the chance that any policy on the left will result in more debt? Surely we should avoid things that will objectively make the country poorer, so there's less money in the
debt that's harder to service as well. If we lose, our credit rating by Brexiting, and particularly if we go for a hard Brexit, a no deal Brexit, we are very likely to have to borrow at much higher rates, which makes it much, much harder to get things done.
Mm. Well, we lost our AAA credit rating under the coalition years, regardless, because there is a big deficit, and that does need to be filled through high taxation on the richest, high taxation on the corporations, and also wealth taxes as well.
Again, on this, we're completely agreed.
Yeah, I think we're going to be very boring and all agree on that.
Exactly, but it hasn't been talked about enough. You know, the 2017 Labour manifesto is obviously a good stepping stone towards the type of Britain we want to see in the future, but we need to look long-term beyond that as well. 50% top rate of tax, is a good start, but I think we can go beyond that and have Scandinavian higher top rate of tax. When it comes to corporation tax, we wanted to reverse it to 2011 levels. We can do better than that. We can do German levels of corporation tax. And when it comes to wealth taxes, we haven't done anywhere near enough when it comes to that. So I think there's a lot more to actually build on the 2017 manifesto, which was an extremely good manifesto. And we need to do a lot more to actually raise revenues from the wealthiest in society. And we can use those revenues to actually help public services, not only pay off the deficit as well, but reduce poverty. And if you reduce poverty, that also sees economic knock-ons as well. So a lot of housing benefit is spent on subsidising poverty pay. But if you raise wages to the living wage, then that housing benefit goes down and that money can be spent elsewhere. So it's all about how a government allocates its resources. So that's why it's so important that we actually do have a government that will actually do it rather than carry on under the Conservative or coalition years.
Well, I mean, sorry, just come in there. The thing is, almost every word you just said, I fundamentally agree with. The fact that the country isn't working for people that desperately need things to work for. The fact that it's not okay to keep going with status quo. The status quo is completely unacceptable. And so our objectives, a lot of our means, are pretty much the same and aligned. And yet, on Twitter, somehow we've managed to become seen as enemies, people that can't even talk to each other, even though our aims and our means are exactly the same, which is kind of the problem. If we have something that is very, that is a very, well, obviously Brexit is a massive, huge issue, but if we have one issue that that we disagree on, then somehow that turns people into enemies. And that's why politics has become so toxic right now, that people with the same aims and ambitions can be seen as enemies. It's really sad, Emma.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's two things. One, to go back to what George was saying, I think everything George was saying was right. Mm. But I think we also, one of the things that's really been missing is making a positive case, not just for reallocation of resources, absolutely right, 100% agree with that, but also for some of the more positive things that a state can do. Mm. States have extraordinary abilities that other actors do not have. Mm. So when we're talking about Germany, let's not just talk about their corporation tax rates, but actually about the tripartite way that they do apprenticeships, where instead of being seen as in opposition to each other, business and unions and the government actually all work together to have a much, much yep. better education system than we do. Let's talk about the ways that they can intervene at a local state level to change the way that their local markets work. And I always get really annoyed when people use markets, because actually when you walk down the street and ask people what a market is, they think it's where you buy the fish and the vegetables. Mm, yeah. So, but how their local economy works, yeah. how they can actually sort of drive different ways of changing people's behaviour in a really positive way. I think that's something that's missing. In terms of the debate thing, I mean, I get this. I mean, I'm a woman with an opinion on Twitter, so I obviously get a load of nonsense all the time.
Yeah.
And I also, because what will happen is one day I'll write an article
yep.
praising Jeremy Corbyn,
mm-hmm.
saying I think he's done this thing really, really well. And I'll get a bunch of followers who love Jeremy Corbyn.
Mm.
And then the next week I'll go, well, I think Jeremy Corbyn really messed that up. And they'll all be like, why? Why have you abandoned us in our hour of need? And I'm like, but I just think the same things I've always thought.
Yeah, but that's the personality politics. I mean, it keeps us into a very rigid view of thinking that as if we agree with the ideals of somebody, we have to agree with every single aspect of their personality and every action they ever take, which is really, really problematic. George, have you got any last points?
I think on social media you've seen the death of nuance. So I think it's really difficult to get nuance across in 280 characters, and you can do Twitter threads and whatnot, but unfortunately it might be a bit too late. So it's really difficult, and social media is fantastic for many, many reasons. We can spread messages to a large amount of people instantly, and, you know, the last 2017 general election was shifted and moulded by social media and many positive ways, but then you've also got fake news, and you've got the lack of nuance and lack of debate. It's very worrying. So you know, we just got to keep on doing our thing. You know, Emma and Femi, just keep going.
Exactly, and you too. I try not to be party political, but we need a new government ASAP. It is an absolute national priority. So thank you very much, George. And we'll continue. We'll talk later, and probably on Twitter when our followers decide whether or not they think we should go to war with each other. But yeah, cheers, good to talk. And we will be coming back after the break with two people. We're going to have Tom Copley, who's from Labour, and we also have Ruben Young from Priced Out. But we will get back to you in a second. This has been The Floor Is Yours. See you in a couple of minutes.
The whole housing situation is a mess. Theresa May has promised to spend an extra £2 billion a year on houses. And you're like, good! Because as it stands, the government only builds 1% of the new homes in Britain, which means private companies are providing homes for vulnerable families, and that's why we have poor doors. Do you know what a poor door is? Right, when a company builds a big, new, shiny block of flats, they have a grand entrance at the front for the rich people, and then around the back, they have a separate entrance for the affordable homes. It's shocking, isn't it? Rich people here, scum! Use the cat flap. That's not social housing. That's social segregation. And all we hear is, we can't build enough houses. There's no money. There's no money. Bullshit! Kensington and Chelsea Council had a budget surplus of £274 million. Over 60 people died in the fire at Grenfell, and hundreds more lost everything. Do you know how much it would have reportedly cost to have fire-resistant cladding? £5,000. £5,000. And not only did they have 274 million in the bank, but in 2015, they gave an opera group 5 million. People need sprinklers, not fucking Pavarotti. We have a housing crisis in this country. So if you're a Tory MP, a house is a fucking house. Actually, it's more than that. It's a home. It's a place to sleep and laugh and cry and love and sing and eat, and everyone needs one. And if there's money for the Queen or money in a council's bank account, then there's money to make sure something like Grenfell never, ever happens again.
So, that was Russell Howard, and that hit me hard because, I mean, it's ridiculous the extent to which we have the ability to solve such a shameful problem in the country regarding homelessness, regarding people that are unable to afford their own homes, and we are simply prioritizing your Kensingtons, your massive mansions that often don't have people living in them, like massive square footage that could house hundreds of people each, and it's ridiculous. It's the ability, and I mean, not to get all Uncle Ben on you here, but with great power comes that responsibility to actually fix this problem. So here we're joined by Tom Copley, and we're joined by Reuben Young. Welcome to the show. This is the floor is yours. So Tom, you are the spokesperson for housing for Labour. And I think
on the London Assembly, yes. not Nash. I can't claim to be
one day.
Someone in the Labour Party having a heart attack right about now.
John Healy, probably.
But my point is, what do you think? How would Labour do housing different to the Conservatives?
Well, to go back to, I listened in earlier to what Emma was saying, build more bloody houses. But specifically, you've got to build the right kind of houses. And Labour does have a commitment. It is actually one of John Healy's commitments for 100,000 social rented homes a year across the country. And you may have seen recently Shelter's report came out, which called for, I think, over 20 years, 3.1 million social houses. So fundamentally, at the core of what Labour is going to do is really get us back into getting the public sector back into the business of delivering housing. Now, it's starting to happen. I mean, you've got councils around London which are building new council housing for the first time in a generation. And the government has finally removed the limits on their borrowing to build housing, which is really, really important. But we also need the government to actually invest properly as well. And Sadiq Khan, the mayor, estimates we need the government to invest at least an extra £2.7 billion a year in London alone.
Well, I mean, we saw what happened with Grenfell. Russell Howard just touched on it. The idea that... Do you think there needs to be more regulation, more stricter regulation on how these houses get built? I mean, you saw who... I mean, they the idea of, what was it, housing that was fit for human habitation, was deemed to be questionable in Parliament, which is just embarrassing.
I'm so glad that you mentioned that the homes fit for human habitation. It's not a bill anymore, it's an act. And that, I've got to say, huge congratulations to Karen Buck, MP for Westminster North, who has been pushing at this for years, and you're right. Two attempts. She put a private member's bill down a few years ago on it. It was talked out by Philip Davis, that awful Tory MP. She tried to amend some government legislation that was voted down by the Conservatives. And it was only after Grenfell, actually, that the Conservatives realised they really couldn't be opposing this anymore.
Well done.
It's shocking. It really is shocking. Can I just say on building quality? Because yes, we need to build numbers. We also need to build quality.
And size,
which is really important.
Size does matter, guys.
It does. Don't get me started on micro homes. But building regulations. I'm sorry. Why was it ever considered acceptable and safe to put flammable plastic on tower blocks? I mean, deregulation across the board has been a huge, huge problem. And I say, you know, people talk about red tape. Red tape saves lives.
What happened at Grenfell, I mean, horrific tragedy. But the wider thing is that what they were trying to do was hide social housing. pretend that it doesn't. And that just speaks to a mindset that we've had about social housing for far, far too long.
And by that you're referring to the fact that the cladding was put on to make it look pretty for the rich people, for the rich people that live across the way. And Ruben, I mean, you work for Priced Out.
Yes.
And and obviously, as the name suggests, it's about people that are priced out of certain areas.
Yes, so we are a voice for people who are priced out of home ownership or priced out of the areas they want to live. Mm. And I think the main problem, the reason why we're in this situation, I think Tom's exceedingly right. We need to build more bloody houses. Mm. I think what neither major political party has the balls to admit, though, is the one of the biggest reasons for the crisis we're in is that we have a bizarre system in this country where every single home we build has to traverse a political approval process in which people local to the area, who by definition already have homes in the area, get a voice. But the people who would actually be the beneficiaries of those developments who are moving in get absolutely no say at all. I think we need to totally reform planning in order to build anywhere near the homes we need.
So, I hear you in terms of the people who are in local area, the ones that are the ones that get the say over whether or not houses get built. But how do we get around that?
By having rules about what we can build and where, and taking the politics largely out of it. I mean, there should be a democratic way of using land, but we should move the democracy upstream so that people vote on the rules that govern planning and not on every single new home we build. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Can I, as someone who sits with my other hat on as a Lewisham councillor, as someone who sits on a planning committee, I do want to slightly defend the planning system. I do agree with you, particularly where you've got developments with significant amounts of social housing. It's incredibly frustrating when you get people who are well housed, who often own their own homes, objecting to that. But it is important that we have good, decent planning, and particularly that councils have the ability to push back on developments that contain very little social housing or don't bring some other sort of social benefit.
So let's have a rule about how much social housing needs to be in a major development.
And I think we need much more ability for councils to enforce those targets. They're targets. They're not. We need much more ability to enforce those. Also, we need to be getting people actually involved in planning. So much of what we call planning is actually development control. It's not planning at all.
And what's the difference?
So development control is someone puts a planning application. You object to it because you don't like a tower block going up. So it's reactive. Mm. Planning is proactive. Planning is saying we want to come up with a vision for our area and our community. We need this in terms of housing and social housing. We need this in terms of doctor's surgeries and schools and roads and, parks. And it's actually about building up a vision. But because, particularly with the years of austerity, it's been pared back and pared back to just this reactive, I don't want that to be built thing.
Which is kind of the problem.
And again, this goes back to what I was saying, is it's not just about building housing, vital though that is, build more bloody houses, but it's about making sure that those houses aren't just built in some vacuum, particularly outside of London. You quite often get an estate built in the middle of nowhere with inadequate transport links, inadequate access, no shops, no community centre, no local school. So it's about thinking about things on a much bigger level. And that speaks to some of the stuff that both Ruben and Tom have just been saying. Mm. So taking it out of, do I want this house or even this estate built here? More thinking about what kind of community do I want to live in and how do we get there?
Yeah, I mean, I just to plug, a friend of mine, Tessa Milligan, she's a Labour activist. She's talked about the triangle, the fact that you need to have that three-pronged triangle of housing, jobs, and transport, because if you don't have all three, then it's not going to work. You need to have people that can afford to live there, which means they need to have a job. They need to be able to get to their job, which means you need transport. They need a place to fucking live.
Absolutely. And there's many examples. There's a classic one in Croydon, the New Addington estate, which for many it was built sort of away from transport, away from jobs, and it had enormous amounts of problems on the estate because of that. Then the Croydon tram link came in. Mm. It's now much better connected. People can get to jobs.
Yep.
And it's massively improved the area. Yet you've got to think of these things holistically.
Exactly.
That's really interesting, because New Addington, when I was growing up, was almost slang for a bit rubbish. I was going to say another word there, by the way. And it's great to hear that that's changed, because I knew some really great people from there, but they were just disconnected from everybody else, from everything else.
But I mean, as you mentioned, obviously, priced out house price inflation. How do you deal with that?
by building more houses, by building more social rented houses, by building more market houses, by building more market sale, market rent, absolutely everything, build it everywhere.
Which does come to the triangle we mentioned, that if we invest in areas that don't have a lot of investment in terms of jobs, infrastructure, industry, then it will mean that it will become more attractive to work in those places, which means that there'll be more houses to be built there, it would make more sense to be built there. It also, as I mentioned before, would mean that London would stop being the sole land of opportunity in the country.
Absolutely. But so you're so right that the two things we need to do are build more homes where there's demand and take more demand where there are fewer jobs.
Exactly.
But far too often, this idea of rebalancing the economy away from London is used as an argument against building homes. Mm. And it's absolutely not either or. We need to do both.
How do people use that as an argument against building homes?
Because when I speak at events and I say we need to build loads and loads more homes in high demand areas, they say, no, let's rebalance the economy instead. Let's send everyone...
Yeah, but we're not doing either.
No, it's both. Obviously, it's both. It takes a ridiculous mentality to think that, as I just mentioned, it works, and you have to have all three for it to actually make any sense. But, I mean, the way Tenants Act also the way Those Who Own Homes Act, and they often mistreat tenants, right to buy. You've just released a report, Tom, about right to buy wrong for London. What is that about?
So what this does, it updates some work I did 5 years ago when I looked at the proportion of council homes that were sold under right to buy that are now owned and rented out by private landlords.
Yep.
And 5 years ago, 36%, which is still a high proportion. Now it's 42%. That's 42% of the homes that were built for the public good to be let at social rent now being rented out by private landlords at market rate, sometimes back to the very councils that were forced to sell them at a discount. It is an absolutely ludicrous situation because councils have a duty, rightly, to house certain people, particularly families, when they are homeless.
Yeah.
They haven't got enough council housing because they were forced to sell a lot of it off and for many years weren't really able to build any more. And so they have to house people somewhere. So they end up paying these extortionate rates to private landlords. And I find it's sort of almost, apart from anything else, an indignity that these councils, these homes that they built, they are now having to pay private landlords to rent back. It is a complete mess of a system and we need to end the right to buy.
There's also a huge community cohesion problem as well that comes along with it, because what you get is these estates that have been built and some of the people in there have lived there their whole lives, and you get a lot of right-wing blethering on about how appalling it is for people to stay in social housing when they're actually successful, something that I find really distasteful.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
idea that you tell social housing tenants that success doesn't live here disgusts me,
absolutely.
Frankly. But equally, what you then get is with the houses that have been sold, there is much more financial incentive for those landlords to rent those on much short-term lease so they can raise the rents the rents every time the new leases leave. So those people don't have as much connection to their community. They're very much fleeting. They're transient. They're not coming in and staying. So they don't necessarily look after the front garden, for example. And they don't make connections with their neighbours because they're not going to stay there. So it's really difficult. You've got people who, it's not their fault. They're not bad people, but they haven't got the connection to the area because they haven't got the ability to stay there long term.
Yeah. Well, we've got to also, I mean, as you mentioned, the ability to have housing that actually is fit for human habitation. I mean, we saw that regarding Grenfell. And the thing that annoyed me most about that is the fact that the tenants actually wrote to the landlords, the owners, the council, and basically said, please give us cladding that isn't flammable. And they basically said, yeah, well, we will do that. And then they put on cladding that was flammable. They actually chose a specific brand, a specific model, and they put the wrong thing on and just passed it off as that, which is just unforgivable. But regarding housing that's not fit for human habitation, I mean, you've got the £1 home scheme, which is basically where you give families that have the ability to, well, the means to renovate and bring an accommodation up to snuff, and then they have the obligation to live there for a certain period of time, and then after that you basically improve the housing in that area and they move out and you've got more housing that's actually fit for human habitation. What do you think of that, guys?
I think they're doing that in Stoke, aren't they? It's not something that would work in London simply because of the economics of it. There's such demand for London. I think in low demand areas, it's an interesting thing to look at potentially, but it's not one for London.
And how do you deal with bad landlords? Because
regulation,
and prosecution,
regulation.
Yeah, regulation, and actually, enforcing the regulation.
Because one of the I don't mean to be too critical of local authorities because their budgets are so stretched, but they do find it difficult to enforce. One of the problems is if they take a landlord to court, they don't get the fines from the landlord. So there's a big cost involved to local authorities prosecuting landlords, and few benefit. They can issue a civil penalty notice where the local authority will then get up to £30,000 in fines. But if they do that, the landlord doesn't get a criminal conviction.
Not easy. I mean, I remember I was in Brussels for 6 months. No, 12 months, actually. No, I think it was 6 months. And my landlord, I wasn't a fan. basically moved in, and then and this was in violation of the contract, she told us that hot water and heating were entirely at her discretion.
Wow.
Whoa.
And so there was many, many nights where we'd be under the covers and be able to see your own breath, where if you try and have a shower after midnight, no, that would be icicles dropping onto your body. That was something we had to put up with for 6 months. Tell me that doesn't happen here, please.
No, I wish I could.
Just check out the Vent Your Rent hashtag and you'll find a hell of a lot of stories. Very similar. Ceilings falling down, no hot water, landlords are little subs in.
Rats and mice.
Our friends, the Wilsons, those awful landlords in Kent. And Mrs. Wilson, she was prosecuted for failing to provide hot water for a disabled tenant. Appalling. That's absolutely appalling. And because we in Brussels, in Belgium, of course, you've got longer tenancies and more tenants' rights. But here, you can be kicked out 2 months' notice after 6 months. So if you make it, a lot of people are afraid to complain.
Well, I mean, if we improved living conditions a bit, I mean, surely that would. It's one of, like I said, there's a triangle of things. It's all interconnected. And if we improved living conditions, for example, if people didn't have to go to sleep cold, then that maybe sure that would help with the NHS a little bit.
And productivity.
And productivity,
which we have a massive problem with in this country.
Yeah, home is the foundation of people's lives, and the impact on people's health, mental and physical, on children's education. If there's nowhere for them to do their homework, it's absolutely profound. And if we start to get housing right, so many other things will fall into place, and we'll be spending less money on elderly people going into hospital because they haven't got proper heating and things like that. We've got to sort this out, and we have enough stress and things to worry about in our lives without worrying whether or not we'll be evicted or be able to pay the rent at the end of the month.
Home is where you're supposed to feel safe. That's safe as houses. That's a phrase we use. I don't know how long we can keep using that phrase.
I was just going to say, regarding being priced out, to what extent is gentrification a problem? As in, to what extent are there rich communities moving into areas that were previously poor? And how often is that happening?
That's a really interesting question. I think that often the debate gets a bit muddied because people think that it's the fault of the often kind of young professionals moving into a place which is forcing the usually poorer communities out, when in fact they're both caused by the same thing, which is that there aren't enough homes near the communities we're talking about. If we just built enough housing nearby, it wouldn't be an issue. It's a bad thing for the people who live there. It's a consequence of us not building enough homes, not of us inviting all of these young professionals in, and they shouldn't be demonised. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It's not the fault of anybody. I mean, consistently the government fails, then we end up blaming the people rather than the people that make the decisions. The problem. apparently, 4 in 10 houses do not meet the basic health well-being criteria.
Is that across all tenures? I mean, there's a decent home standard which is used in the social rented sector, but other tenures are measured against it. And actually, it's the private rented sector that has the lowest compliance with that standard. I think that's a slightly different standard, but there is a huge problem with quality.
Well, I mean, I don't know. This is one of the things that I probably should have debated this with George a second ago, but one of the things that I talk about regarding Brexit is the fact that Brexit voters were 100% correct that the country does not work for people right now. And they were tired of it. And after 40 years of nothing really getting better in their area, they saw the Brexit voters as a vote that might actually change things significantly, unlike the first-past-the-post votes, which don't actually change a thing. And so one thing we desperately need is that, obviously, Brexit, because of the economic damage, would limit our ability to make those changes. But after that, how do we get the Tories to actually do something between now and the next general election? How do we actually say, you have messed up so bad that we voted for something so harmful, if you don't change things immediately, you are inviting the far right to basically rise to power, because people will say, well, status quo hasn't provided an answer, we'll look for something else. Because, I mean, obviously, if Labour was in government immediately, you'd see radical change, because it would be Corbyn at the helm of things. But how do we basically hold the feet to the fire of the people that are currently in power to say, change now or your party's finished?
You have to tell them they're going to lose power. There's nothing they care about more than that power. And you have to say the only way that you've got any chance of hanging on to power. You may not want to be full fat Corbyn, but Corbyn light, that's your only option, because you just can't. One of the things that Corbyn becoming leader of the Labour Party has done is shift the narrative quite severely to the left. Theresa May, when she first stood on the steps of Downing Street and talked about the just about managing and, you know, people in real distress, that's what she was saying. She just had no answers. Well, we've given her a bunch of answers. She needs to, and frankly, steal our clothes. Go for it.
I would agree with that. And actually, the narrative has shifted on housing since the Cameron Osborne days. I mean, let's remember, literally, two or three years ago, we faced the prospect in London of basically all of our council housing being sold off to pay for a right to buy discount for housing association tenants.
Seems like
they were going to do a forced sale.
It
does seem like a different world. And, we have had the borrowing cap lifted, which is a good thing. The Tories are even consulting on longer tenancies for private tenants. Doesn't go far enough, but I think it goes back to what Emma was saying about fearing losing power. Renters, because so many more people rent, are a growing electoral force, and so the Tories have realised they've got to do something, and they're not going to go as far as we would like, but hold the feet to the fire, say to them, you're going to lose unless you do something about it. And obviously I hope there's going to be a general election sooner rather than later and we can kick them out.
I think that's right. Another thing is renters are coming together a lot more, particularly in London, than they have before. Campaigns like London Renters Union, Generation Rent are doing a great job of mobilising the kind of renter votes, which is definitely going to help with this feet to the fire kind of idea.
Absolutely.
And I think also we need to have the opinions of people whose families are breaking up because people are moving to the only places they can go to for jobs, for work, for housing. There is a huge anger out there, and that was part of what drove Brexit, because people are losing the communities they once had, because we just don't, outside of London, we just don't build them anymore. We don't support communities in all the ways that we've been talking about, and that's a boiling under anger that's not going to be solved by Brexit, and so it's just going to continue to boil up.
Absolutely. So if we were just really, really quick, other than build more bloody houses, what would be your message to how do we get more young people on the housing ladder? What would you say, Ruben?
Well, firstly, I don't like the idea of the housing ladder for a start. It makes homes sound like investments, and you climb up and trade up for the next one and the next one. But in terms of improving people's life outcomes through housing, I think private renters' rights are a huge important thing. Longer tenancies, we need to look into rent controls as well. And the other one is property taxes, which are absolutely broken in this country. Council tax, for example, the most expensive properties are taxed at about 0.1% of their value a year, whereas the ordinary properties are taxed at about 1.5%. It's just a completely regressive system that makes no sense whatsoever.
That's
minimum, we need to rebound council tax, but I'd much rather see something more radical like a land value tax.
Cool. Tom?
Those three words, land value tax. I did a report on this for the London Assembly a couple of years ago, and we can replace the three main property taxes. You won't end up with a situation where people owning £30 million houses in Kensington pay the same council tax as a middle class family in somewhere else in London. It would incentivise development, and it would raise an awful lot of money to invest in infrastructure and affordable housing.
Cool. And Emma?
Well, I'd echo land value tax, but I won't be boring and echo it for too long. So I'm going to say end End right to buy.
End right to buy.
End right to buy. I mean, it's just, it, there's no incentive for a council to build a whole bunch of really, really great, impressive properties just to have them nicked off them at a massive discount.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, guys, thank you very much, Tom, Emma, and Ruben.
Thank you.
This has been The Floor Is Yours. Clearly, we need to build more fucking houses.
I'll get that on a t-shirt.
I would like the right to buy that. Thank you very much. This has been The Floor Is Yours. See you next week.
Saying in her sleep, brother's got a date to keep, he can't hang around. Our house, it has a crowd. There's always something happening, and it's usually quite loud. Our mum, she's so house proud. Nothing ever slows her down, and a mess is not allowed.
You've been listening to a FUBAR Radio podcast. For more information, go to FUBARradio.com.